From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we feature a rebroadcast of one of our most requested shows. We hear from a leading psychologist and an acclaimed novelist as they describe life with manic depression. Kay Redfield Jamison co-wrote a textbook on the illness, but what she knew as a clinician didn't make it easier to live with manic depression. She describes her severe mood swings in her memoir, An Unquiet Mind. Kay Gibbons' novel, Sights Unseen, is a young girl's story of life with a manic depressive mother. Gibbons was diagnosed with manic depression 15 years ago. Manic depression, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Manic depression is a disease that distorts moods and thought, can incite dreadful behavior, destroy the basis of rational thought, and erode the desire and will to live. That's how Kay Redfield Jamison describes it in her book An Unquiet Mind, a memoir about her own bouts with the extreme mood swings of manic depression. Jamison is also the co-author of a widely used textbook on manic depression and the author of Touched by Fire, about writers, composers, and artists who had the illness. She's a professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. It was only shortly before the publication of this memoir last year that she publicly disclosed she had the illness herself. Jamison says during a manic period, one can experience everything from ecstasy to paranoia. The low brings indescribable pain, lethargy, and hopelessness. She told me about her own range of experience before she started taking medication.
When I was manic, I did everything from spending inordinate amounts of money, like $30,000, $40,000, on things that I had absolutely no use for, things from ranging from snake bite kits to extremely expensive watches to jewelry to things, you know, I think I gave away money. I mean, just completely worthless sorts of spending of money. To just going around and, you know, you just do this kind of enthusiastic babbling and trying to convince people these great ideas and schemes and plans that you have. It's an extravagant state. It's a highly energetic state. It's a contagious state. I mean, one of the things that's, I think, to me, is from a human point of view, the most interesting thing about manic depressive illness is it's so tied to moods, and moods are very, very human sorts of things. And moods are also very contagious. So that when people are high and mildly manic, their enthusiasm levels tend to be very contagious. People tend to, you know, the level of energy is just sort of bubbles out and creates kind of a high energy field around the individual who's manic. And up to a point, this can be very seductive and very enticing to other people. After a certain point, it becomes very irritating and obnoxious and exhausting. In depression, I think the thing that you're asking, what was the most extreme thing I did, is certainly the most extreme thing, and the thing that's absolutely most, for myself, completely unthinkable, was that I tried to kill myself. I mean, I just can no more imagine wanting to die now when I'm normal. I mean, I'm terrified of death. I don't want to die. I love life. I enjoy life. And I feel very fortunate in having great friends and a great existence, really, and a great world and a great job and great colleagues. It's inconceivable to me that I would want to die. And yet, when I was depressed, it was inconceivable to me that I would want to continue to live.
What made you so certain that life was no longer worth living?
It was just clear. I mean, depression is very convincing in the same way that mania is very convincing. Moods are very convincing. If you have no energy, and if you can't think, and you can't reason, and you have no hope, and you have no reason to expect that it's going to change, there is no reason to live. And certainly in my case, there wasn't. I couldn't stand who I had become.
How did you reconcile, when you're going through these incredible mood swings, how did you reconcile the highs and the lows and the person you were when you were high with the person you were when you were depressed?
Well, I think it's not, if when you're high and when you're low, you don't try and reconcile much of anything. It's really when you're your normal self that you look at the chaos around you that's become your life and you wonder, where on earth did I go? You know, where am I in all of this? I think it's very hard if you, I mean, I was brought up in a very conservative family and a very conservative lifestyle, which I cherished, and I still do cherish. And to look around me at some of the things that I'd done when I was manic and just flamboyantly manic, it's just very hard for me to sort out who was who in there.
You write that at first your illness seemed to be an extension of yourself, of your changeable moods and enthusiasms. When did you realize it was more than that?
Well, I think I had sort of fleeting glimpses of judgment and insight. I think that when I was brought up, in an Air Force family, and as I say, a very conservative family, there weren't really words and labels. I mean, there wasn't, you know, people know the word depression now, and perhaps less so the words manic depression. But at the time I was growing up, these words just weren't used. The concept wasn't there. And I first got ill when I was in high school. I got profoundly depressed, and actually I got quite hypomanic. But to me, it was that there was something wrong, but I didn't think of it as an illness. And even though I went on then to do graduate work in psychology and took courses, clinical coursework and so forth, I still somehow did not attach it to myself. And I think this is a problem that an awful lot of people have. I mean, the major problem with mood disorders is not that they're not treatable, because they are. I mean, depression and manic depression are extremely treatable diseases. The problem is that people don't recognize what they're going through as illnesses. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I think that these illnesses are very hard to label as illnesses because they seem tied up with one's personality and moods, and we don't think of that as disease.
Well, as you say in your memoir, manic depression is an illness that is biological in origin, yet it feels psychological.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's, you know, it's a very subtle point, and I think even years after studying mood disorders for a living, as it were, and having it and having the illnesses in my family, I still find it at times difficult to sort out what's just kind of a reaction to life and what's a disease. I mean, I have much more of a sense now, and it's unequivocally clear to me that what I have is a very bad form of a disease. But for a long time, you know, you can just sort of say, well, maybe this is just me.
Can you give us a layperson's synopsis of what we know about the biological basis of mood swing disorders?
Well, certainly with manic depression, we know that it's genetic, and there's a lot of very exciting research going on now. A lot of geneticists and molecular biologists looking for the genes for manic depressive illness, and I have no doubt that within 5 years we'll know at least one of the genes, if not more, for manic depressive illness. I don't think very many people now question the genetic basis. Depression's a lot more complicated. Some forms of depression seem to be heritable. Others perhaps a little bit less so. But again, I think that the biological underpinnings for depression and manic depression are much more recognized than they used to be.
When you did start seeking help, you were prescribed lithium, but you fought it for a long time. Why didn't you want to take lithium?
I fought it. I wish I hadn't. You know, I lost a lot of years of my life, and I regret it now, but I think it's something that I probably had to do. I fought it because, I mean, at a somewhat simplistic level, and perhaps the easiest level to understand, but not the most real level, the simplest level was I had very bad side effects. At the time I first started taking lithium, lithium was prescribed at much higher levels than it is now. I'm now on lithium and I have virtually no side effects, but at that time I was on high levels and I found it difficult to read. I had a very rare reaction to lithium in terms of a very bad blurring of vision and an impairment in my concentration. I got nauseated. But I think that wasn't the real reason. The real reason was I thought that, you know, I shouldn't have to take a medication. It was not clear to me in my own mind that what I had was a disease because I would feel well again. And I think it's something that you see not only in psychiatric illness, but you see it in, you know, diabetes and chronic heart disease, that once people start feeling better again, it's very hard to stay on chronic medication. I just fought. I fought like a crazed weasel. I really resisted the idea that I was mentally ill, that I had something that I couldn't just control with will and intellect and personality, that I couldn't just exert sort of enough, energy over it to control it. It's hard. It's a hard thing to accept.
What's so interesting to hear that coming from you, a psychiatrist.
Yes, as a psychologist. Yes, you would think that one would be more intelligent, but I just wasn't. I think that one of the reasons why I have ended up studying manic depressive illness, not just strictly from the medical point of view and the scientific point of view, but I've also been very interested in spending a lot of research time on why people don't take medication, is because it's such a profound problem of treating people with mood disorders. I mean, a lot of people who have mood disorders are very willing to take medication straight away, and they have no problem staying on it. And that's great. And that's a wonderful group of people to deal with, because you don't really have to deal with anything in that sense. But there's a whole other group of people that just resists and fights back and says, it's going to go away, denies the illness, denies the need for it. And these are people who, die because it is such a lethal disease if it's left untreated. And the illness gets worse if you don't treat it. I mean, that's something I also knew. I knew as a researcher, I knew as a scientist, I knew as a clinician that manic depressive illness gets worse over time if it's left untreated. But somehow I still resisted. I mean, I should say I haven't resisted for a long time. I'm totally convinced. As my psychiatrist said, I've run that particular experiment enough times now.
So you've been on medication for a long time. Do you miss anything about the highs or the lows? It's the highs, I'd imagine you'd miss, and not the lows.
I don't miss the lows. I do not miss the lows, not for a second.
What about all the energy from the mania, the energy, the self-confidence and enthusiasm?
Well, I think what I miss about the mania is that, well, there's several things. One certainly is the high energy level, but I have a pretty high energy level anyway, and I think I tend to exhaust people around me as is. So I'm not sure that it's energy so much anymore. There's an easy flow of ideas, and there's a wonderful sense of just vitality and just this infectious enthusiasm and, joie de vivre and passion for life. And that's very seductive. It's very hard to give up. There's an intensity, in the same way that I think that love brings a certain kind of intensity into one's life. And war does in a very, very different sort of way. Why is it that people remember war experiences, even though they're so awful? It's because I think there's a certain intensity and a certain sense of shared experience, perhaps. So it's hard to give that up, actually.
You recently asked your psychiatrist for a copy of your medical records.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most valuable part or the most surprising part about reading them?
I think it was a very interesting experience. It's not that I forget how bad depression is, but I think in order to go on and in order to survive and live, you have to deny the degree of despair that you experienced. And what I had forgotten was the degree of misery of my depression. And just reading these very cool clinical notes about how suicidal I had been, how awful I felt for week after week, month after month, was not just disturbing, it was very frightening.
My guest is psychiatrist Kay Redfield Jamison. Her memoir about her own bouts with manic depression is called An Unquiet Mind. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kay Redfield Jamison. She's a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University and the author of a memoir about her own manic depression called An Unquiet Mind. I'd like to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about your suicide attempt. Would that be okay?
Sure.
How did life look to you at the time that you said, it's not worth it anymore?
Life to me seemed absolutely pointless. Every minute of the day was an exercise in futility and pain. And there seemed to me no reason to go on. It seemed to me that I was incapable of doing my work in the way in which I wanted to do it, and I was incapable of being the kind of friend that I was used to being, and I was incapable of being the kind of family member that I thought I wanted to be. Every aspect of my life seemed a failure, and I wasn't used to failure. I could not stand the pain. It's just a very hard thing to describe. There simply was no point in living.
Were you in physical pain, too?
No. Certainly a lot of people who get depressed are in physical pain. No, I wouldn't say I was in physical pain. I would get,
not even bad headaches?
No. A lot of people do get bad headaches. A lot of people do get pain, get stomach pains and so forth. No, I didn't. My pain went straight to my brain, as it were.
What method did you decide to use to take your life?
I decided to kill myself with an overdose of lithium because that's what I had available to me, and I thought if I took a drug that would keep me from vomiting it up, which I got a large amount of, I knew that the drug would kill me, and I knew that I was on sort of a quasi-suicide watch from my doctors, and most of my friends were doctors. So that I knew that I was not going to get access to very lethal medications and that would require a smaller number of pills. So I knew that lithium was the only thing that I could really do.
Well, you'd prepared well for the job. How were you saved?
I was saved by the fact that you can prepare for irrational acts only so well. And I think that I thought that I would have, I would just go off into a coma. It's not one of those things that they teach you. You know, here I was really treating people with the illness and certainly had experience with other people who had attempted suicide or who had committed suicide, patients, friends, whatever, colleagues. And yet I thought I would just sort of take my medication and fall into a coma. But actually the fact of the matter, and so I took my telephone and I put it many rooms away so I wouldn't answer it. I knew that I couldn't take the phone off the hook because if I took the phone off the hook and my family or my friends called, they would immediately have somebody over there because they knew I was very depressed. So I just removed the phone to another room. And what happened is my brother was in Paris and he was calling to see how I was doing. And I was really pretty comatose, quasi-comatose. And I must have crawled on my hands and knees when I heard the phone ringing. And just, you know, however it is that a very drugged brain works. And I picked up the phone and my voice was very slurred and my brother called a doctor.
Looking back, how do you interpret that? Do you think in your semi-comatose state you decided to live or that you heard the bell and just reflexively went to the telephone?
Well, I suppose I'd like to think, you know, that it was unconscious desire to live, but I think it's far more prosaic than that. I think at that point, I mean, I'd had a lot of, you know, ambivalence about dying or I would have died long before that. I was depressed for many months. At that time, it was absolutely clear to me I wanted to die, so that the ambivalence, such as it was, had been pretty washed out. No, I think it's just you do reflexively certain things that are programmed into you. I can never, I mean, to this day, I can't not answer telephones, you know.
Get an answering machine.
Well, I've got one of those.
So what did the world look like when you came to? I mean, what if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us, what if you remember, what were your first thoughts?
My first thought was, you know, I was just desperately sick. I mean, I was vomiting. Lithium is used for training coyotes not to eat sheep, you know, and if you put a tiny bit of lithium on a sheep carcass, coyotes won't go anywhere near it because it's such a drug that really causes vomiting. And so I spent a long time vomiting. And I was just in and out of a coma. I had a great friend who was a wonderful, wonderful man who kept 24-hour watch on me and walked me around so that, you know, I didn't end up having to go to a hospital. So I don't remember much of that. I remember finally coming out of it and looking at bruises on my arms where I'd had all my blood levels drawn repeatedly and saying what happened and, you know, why am I alive and so forth and I don't want to be alive. It was a very terrible time because it's not like I sort of woke up and felt perky and, gee, I'm really glad to be alive. I wasn't glad to be alive. I was just as depressed as I had been.
So after you were, you know, back in the world of the living again, what did you change in your life?
Well, I certainly stayed on my medication. I don't suppose I changed a whole lot. I had much more of a deep commitment in my professional life to studying psychosis, to studying suicide, and to studying why people don't take their medications, and to studying the psychological aspects of manic depressive illness as well as the medical side. I mean, I really came out of all of it with an absolute determination to try and do something about the illness, to see how, to try and change how it was perceived by society because of the terrible stigma that is attached to it. To try and make a difference, I guess.
You know, in your memoir, you ask the question, are manic depressives an endangered species? You mean because of drugs that can treat the disorder?
Well, less because of drugs than because the fact that the illness is genetic means that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we will have genetic tests where you can tell if a fetus has manic depressive illness, has the gene or genes for manic depressive illness. Ultimately, society may be able to develop gene therapies that prevent the development of the illness altogether. You may be infected, be able to find out which children are at high risk and medicate them, pre-medicate them before they ever experience severe mood swings.
Would we be losing anything if manic depression did become extinct?
Well, I think this is an issue that's a very real ethical issue. I think the one side of it is that you will be able to diagnose people earlier and more accurately and treat them and prevent them from having to go through the pain and suffering that manic depressive illness brings along with it, and also develop far more specific treatments that have far fewer, you know, side effects. And that's the good side. The problematic ethical side is actually something we're studying. The Dana Consortium for the Study of Manic Depressive, the Genetics of Manic Depressive Illness, is actually going to be having a big meeting up at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories next year, at the end of next year, looking at that question exactly. What are the ethical aspects of finding gene therapies for an illness that almost certainly confers advantage to society but not to the individual? And these are very fascinating evolutionary biology questions. And the meeting will consist of a large number of molecular biologists, geneticists, clinical psychiatrists, artists, writers, patients, advocacy group members, and ethicists, as well as evolutionary biologists.
Kay Redfield Jamison. Her memoir about manic depression is called An Unquiet Mind. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about manic depression with psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison and with writer Kay Gibbons. Her latest novel is about a mother whose drastic mood swings leave her unable to care for her children. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kay Redfield Jamison. She's written about manic depression from several perspectives. She co-authored a widely used textbook on the subject, wrote a book about famous writers, artists, and composers who had the illness, and wrote a memoir about her own experiences as a manic depressive. It's called An Unquiet Mind. Her own illness has been under control for about 10 years with the help of medication and psychotherapy. Now that your manic depression is regulated by lithium and has been for a bunch of years, what are your mood swings like?
Well, actually, they're pretty mild these days, thank God. I used to have a bad time in the summer, and I could pass on summer probably more easily than the rest of the year. But for the most part, I may get down for a day or two, and I certainly get up for a day or two, but it's nothing. I mean, it's been a few years since I've had a really bad patch, for which I am eternally grateful. I mean, all you have to do is be depressed for about 2 hours to really begin to realize how terrible it is again.
You know, I am not manic depressive, but I do often feel like I'm controlled by moods that seem to have more to do with my internal atmosphere than with anything that's happening externally.
Mm-hmm.
That there's days when I feel like, hey, throw it at me, I can handle it. And other days when just the slightest thing will sink me into this profound depression. And I'm sure it has something to do with whatever chemicals or hormones are coursing through my body at the moment.
Have you ever charted it?
No. Do you recommend that?
Yeah. I mean, if you just do something very simple like the same time every day, because there's a diurnal variation in moods. I mean, you know, so you want to do it at the same time every day. But if you, like at 9 o'clock every night, just rate yourself like +3, -3, on whatever measure you want to use, whether it's energy, enthusiasm, mood, anxiety, whatever. And just chart it out for about 6 months.
And
+3 to -3.
And what will I learn from that?
I bet you will find possibly a 2-week pattern. Possibly a 30-day pattern, but what you will see is probably a definite pattern.
And so if you have figured out the pattern,
mm-hmm.
what do you do with it?
Well, it depends on how strong it is. I mean, like, for example, if you were a clear cyclothymic, which would be like a mild manic depressive, but a very intense version of what you're describing,
mm-hmm.
And say you found out that you were like up 3 days and then down 6 or 7 days and then up 3 days and then down 6 or 7 days. You could tell a whole lot if you did it over the course of a year. One thing is you could check to see if there's seasonal patterns. You could check to see if there are premenstrual patterns. You could check to see if there's anything in your outside life that's contributing to it. But you also can, plan a bit. I mean, if you begin to, the very fact of observing gives you some control, because then you see the pattern and you can say, okay, you know, basically if you've got creative work to do, then you just kind of count on the up days. And if you've got periods where you can begin to see what's the beginning of a down period, then you can just do Mickey Mouse work or administrative work or whatever. You know, it depends on what your work consists of. But you can begin to regulate it at some point. Also, you can see, I mean, much more importantly, from a mood disorder point of view, whether it's getting worse or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's getting worse over time, or as you get older, then you want to just, it's good to have a baseline of that. Because then you can say, okay, if I go get treated, is this treatment making me better? Is it making me worse? Is it making me better in the short term, but making me worse in the long term? You have some sort of baseline then.
You know, the last time we talked after the publication of your book, Touched by Fire, about artists and writers who were manic depressives, there's almost a little skirmish in the station of people who wanted the copy of your book.
Uh-huh.
So many people had relatives who had manic depression, relatives who had been prescribed lithium but weren't taking it,
mm-hmm.
and that was causing serious problems for their friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask you a question related to that. For people who have someone who they're close to who has been prescribed something for a mood disorder and they're not taking it, do you have any recommendation of what might be helpful to do to get the person to take it, especially if they go through these, you know, suicidal periods?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do. you often see that kind of resistance very early on in the disease. And sometimes just showing people, I mean, this is, I think, is an advantage of going to a clinic that specializes in mood disorders, where people know a lot about the course of manic depressive illness, where they can show people the course of the illness over time, because that actually tends to be a fairly convincing sort of thing. If you actually, because most people just sort of think, well, I can always go back on the medication. But the fact of the matter is that it takes a toll if you don't go back on it, and it does get worse. And seeing the natural course of the illness physically, you know, on charts of how it does, you know, in 1,000 patients or something, sometimes can be helpful. It's a situation where education goes a long way. You know, if people are in the area of a university clinic, you know, teaching hospital that has a specialty clinic, there should be sort of educational programs. Often the support groups, you know, like the advocacy groups, like the National Depressive and Manic Depressive Association, this group, DRADA in Baltimore that runs out of Johns Hopkins, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, have family support groups and patient support groups. And often patients are much better able, for obvious reasons, to get other patients to, you know, in the same way that alcoholics are much more able to get people to realize that they're denying that they have a problem. There's a lot of denial in manic depression. And sometimes just you have to hear it from other people. And one of the reasons why one of my colleagues said, well, Katie, did you have to be so honest about your problems about taking lithium, you know? Because I think he thought that it would be better if I just sort of said that I took lithium and I walked off into the sunset and everything was glorious and my life was just all new again. And I said, but that's not true. You know, it wasn't true for me, and it's not true for a lot of people. And one of the reasons why I tried to write as honestly as I could is to say, look, these are the consequences of not taking this medication. You know, I think most people are not aware of the consequences of not taking medication, really, really aware.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Kay Redfield Jamison is a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Her memoir is called An Unquiet Mind. Coming up, novelist Kay Gibbons talks about how manic depression affects her life. This is Fresh Air. The mood swings of manic depression can be disabling. Kay Gibbons' recent novel, Sights Unseen, is the story of a young girl whose mother's mood swings leave her unable to care for the children. Gibbons was diagnosed with manic depression 15 years ago. She's the mother of three children, stepmother of two. Gibbons is the author of several best-selling novels, including A Virtuous Woman and A Cure for Dreams. Her first novel, Ellen Foster, was published in 1987 when she was 27. I asked Gibbons if her mother was manic depressive.
My mother had major depression, although now looking back on her life, I realize that washing the walls with Clorox and water and cleaning window sills with Q-tips and toothpicks, those were not normal activities. So I think I can assign a bit of mania to her, but mainly she was depressed and the depression was exacerbated by intense physical illnesses.
Well, that's really interesting to have the kind of life where when you're really manic, when you really got that energy, what you do is clean with toothpicks and
exactly.
Q-tips.
I think she was no less sick and her moods were no less volatile than someone like Virginia Woolf or Anne Sexton, but I believe that she lacked the lyricism of their insanity. My mother was a farm woman with no intellectual outlets. When my mother became manic and experienced a burst of energy, she had nothing to do but clean.
So for this book, have you drawn on your experiences as a mother or as a daughter, or both?
I drew mainly upon my imagination, and then I imagined what my own three daughters would think about me and feel about me 20 years from now if the illness were to get out of hand. But mainly it's reality filtered through the imagination, and I hope to have produced a product that's actually more real than reality.
I'd like you to do a short reading from the beginning of Sights Unseen, your new novel. This is written from the perspective of the daughter. She's talking about her mother.
I worried about my own lack of influence in her life. If I had a little girl, I thought, I would look at her and discover ways to ground myself. I would find reasons to move out of the haze and into the clearing, where a husband, a son, and a daughter could see me fully and welcome me. If I had a daughter as needy for my love as I was for hers, I could, I thought, will myself to be well for her sake. But mother did not find that inspiration in me. Her illness, manic depression, was beyond her control. Along with my father, I mourned the inability to change her, to restore her. And I worried that later, when she had been back home with us for a while, the pills and doctoring would stop, and she would revert to her old crazy ways, and once more, the voices of my father, my brother, and me would be no more than background noise to her ravings.
The line that really got to me in that reading was, you know, if I had a daughter, I thought I could will myself to be well for her sake. I don't know if you were having troubles or not when you became a mother, but do you think it would be possible to will yourself to be well for the sake of your child?
I do. I organize my life in order to stay well so that I can be a wife, be a mother, and write, and those are my three priorities, and they do come in that order. Because if I'm not a good wife, I can't be a good parent. And if I'm not a good parent, I can't be a good writer. So all of these things are intrinsically bound up. And they're bound up with staying well. And I think that while I am on a major amount of medication, that that is secondary to making sure that I live a very organized and responsible and credible life, that I don't present a false front and become confused. And in the past, when I've gotten sick, it's because I've got let myself get fatigued, or I have presented a facade, a face to the public that was not true to myself. So I've learned how to live and stay well.
Was your mother able to will herself to be well for you?
No, she wasn't. She had heart trouble and had open heart surgery, so she was sick beyond her ability to control the sickness, so she was not able to will herself to be well, and she eventually committed suicide. And I learned my lesson about how to live and how to keep finding that will to live.
Were you already in therapy, drug therapy and talk therapy, when you became a mother?
Yes, I was. I was diagnosed in college. One week I was fine in my classes. I understood everything. I understood everything I read and everything I was told. And the next week I wasn't sure who the president was. I thought it was Richard Nixon and Carter was in office. So I presented myself at the university hospital and was diagnosed and hospitalized that evening.
Kay Redfield Jamison, who has written a lot about manic depression, from a textbook to the subject of artists and who've been manic depressives, and now she has a memoir about her own life as a manic depressive. She writes in her memoir that after she was diagnosed, a doctor told her not to have children because manic depression is genetic. And she says she was really both upset and angry at the way he told her, and that she felt that even when she was at her lowest, even when she was trying to commit suicide, she never regretted being born. And she thought that it would really be foolish to think that you couldn't have children because manic depression has a genetic basis. Did anyone ever tell you that?
It was not known when I had my children that manic depression is inherited through the maternal line. And I think that Jamison writes about that in Touched with Fire, a book about creativity and manic depression. So I think had I known that, I would have had second thoughts about having the children, but I believe I would have done it anyway. Having children was very important to me, and I think that even when I'm depressed, I'm a better mother than most. I'm prouder of being a parent than I am of being a writer.
Do you find yourself watching your children's moods, wondering whether they'll have mood problems?
I'm hypersensitive to my children's moods, and I have a daughter who's moving into puberty, with all the violent hormonal swings, the joy one day and the ability to take teasing and the next day being in tears and crumpled over the way a boy slighted her. And I'm having to learn, because I had an abnormal childhood, what is normal for a 10-year-old and what is not. I have one child who's almost reclusive. She's introverted and she's a great reader. And I've had to learn what is normal for her and what is not. And I've found that I do a great deal of reading about parenting and child rearing so that I can get a gauge, so that I can have some sort of standard for normal growing up behavior.
Now, when did you start experiencing severe mood swings yourself?
I can trace the mood swings back to elementary school, when I would do bizarre things like outlining encyclopedias, reading dictionaries, things that weren't quite normal for an 8-year-old. But I somehow managed to get by and do well in school until I got to college. And within a week of, in a 1 week period, I fell apart and wasn't able to work. And I got myself to a doctor and got help.
Why do you think entering college was such a changeable time for you?
I think I was burned out. I had been a super student. I had been driven to work two jobs after school, make A's, be in the student council, and I completely burned out and became fatigued. And that's one of the reasons, looking back on it, that I try to keep myself from being fatigued now, which is quite unusual to say right in the middle of a large book tour.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you better be careful. Did you feel like you were a changed person after you started getting therapy?
I did. I got to know myself. I got to meet myself, and I came to understand my past, and I understood the illness as a chemical imbalance that could be controlled at first by lithium, which I took, but I wasn't able to write on it because it does tend to impair creativity. And then I started anticonvulsants, and I understood how the brain worked, in as much as a 35-year-old woman can understand how the brain works and not be a neurosurgeon. I know how I operate. So in that way, I am changed. I know about myself now.
My guest is Kay Gibbons, author of the novel Sights Unseen. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest Kay Gibbons is the author of the novel Sights Unseen, about a mother whose mood swings leave her unable to take care of her children. Gibbons was diagnosed with manic depression 15 years ago. Now, do your moods affect your writing, and is there a kind of mood in which you feel you're most productive?
There's a state of being, a point in the spectrum of mood swings, from zero being the abject throes of depression to 10 being the heightened ecstasy of mania, that is in a range from about 6 to 7 and is called hypomania. And Jameson does write about that. And that is the point at which Ideas come very quickly. Images are formed rapidly. One is able to conceive of metaphors and similes with apparent ease, and you seem to be able to do no wrong. You have plenty of emotional and physical energy, and that's where I like to stay. And like Maggie Barnes at the end of the book in Sights Unseen, I'm able to put myself at about that point and stay there.
Now, have you changed your approach to trying to get of getting into the state that you need to get into when you write? Is this a process that has evolved over the years?
It has, and I've learned how to key my life. I've learned at what register I can comfortably work in, and it means that instead of trying to have gourmet dinners 6 or 7 nights a week, we have Pizza Hut on Tuesday night and hot dogs on Thursday. And I don't try to be super mom anymore. I don't try to run the PTA. I don't try to run my children's lives. I've learned how to relax. And I go to bed incredibly early every night.
Now, how often do you make a point of not working and of getting out of that state of hypomania?
Whenever I finish a book, I make sure I take some quality time off, and I've not written since January, and I'm waiting for my well to fill back up. I've been researching the Civil War, so I've read lots of Civil War letters and diaries, and I depend a great deal on my husband to keep me battened down like a sail on a boat, and he does. I put him in charge of part of my life, and I don't have to feel as though I have to micromanage myself all the time.
What part of your life have you put him in charge of?
Watching me. I don't have to monitor myself as intensely and as closely as I did before he was in my life. Before he was around, I had to almost stand and look at myself in the mirror all day and watch my face for signs of the illness. But now he can tell me if I'm getting a little bit too high or getting a little bit too low, and I can sit back and examine my life and see what the issues are, what's going on that's making me hurt or making me dangerously happy. Robert Lowell called mania a state of pathological enthusiasm, which I think is the most wonderful description I've ever heard, and that's the state in which I don't want to be. It's tiring, it's dangerous, and I can't work. So we work in our household at keeping mom well.
What are your worst depressions like now?
When I'm depressed, I tend to watch a lot of television. Lots of those real-life crime drama stories. And I tend to do things that would rot anyone's brain, but since my brain won't engage in any intriguing activities when I'm depressed, I sit and vegetate.
When you married your husband, did he know that you had a problem of mood swings?
Before I married my husband, when we were dating, I gave him a resume. And included on that resume, I had a list of assets and liability, and one of my assets was the ability to cook Northern Italian and Southern American food with equal dexterity. And under the liabilities column was manic depression. So he knew what he was getting into, and he accepted it.
You know, when you say that your husband helps you monitor your states, it helps you let you know when you're getting too high or too low. Do you ever resist him, especially if it's a question of getting too high, you know, getting too manic?
He has tricks, and he can trick me into going to the doctor, trick me into going in and having my blood level checked. And when I'm a little high, my judgment is so impaired that I don't recognize those tricks. But he always manages to lead me back into the right path.
What's the kind of trick that he uses?
He will stay home from work and will shop, and he's doesn't leave me alone. and I enjoy his company immensely, but he does stick closely by me, and he makes sure that I don't go and, you know, buy 57 pairs of shoes or 87 basketballs or invest all the family money in foreign stocks. So he does stick by me, and he keeps a tight rein on me when I'm getting sick.
Is this the kind of thing that you do when you get really manic?
Oh, I do have an outstanding shoe collection, like Melda Marcos, and I don't think she has manic depression. She just likes shoes, but I have amassed a grand quantity of shoes, and I can tell the colors and style of my shoes by my mood swings.
So tell us something about your shoes and how they correspond to your moods.
When I'm depressed and I'm feeling sort of low, I tend to buy black pumps. And when I'm manic, I buy red shoes, or I have some outstanding wingtips, some two-tone wingtips. And I've worn them once, and my husband has pointed them out in the closet as my manic shoes. They're really hideous. But they were very expensive. But so I keep them around. I've not given them away.
Kay Gibbons' latest novel is Sights Unseen. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Duke Ellington's song about being blue, Mood Indigo.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from neurologist Oliver Sacks, and we meet the autistic woman he's described as one of the most remarkable autistic people of all, Temple Grandin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.